business side people who can...
Assume I'm not talking about you either when I say it's about somebody else. And the third thing is, I beg forbearance or forgiveness from the broadcast and digital-only people for some of my emphasis on newspapers. That's my background, and I'm concerned about it in part. I know I'm sure Martin and Bill and others are here too, because newspapers still employ a lot of journalists. And I care about the survival of journalism because we care about the survival of freedom, of democracy, social justice, equality. I think it's a key to all of those things. All those reasons we got into this, or most of us got into this, as opposed to being rich or something like that. So I want to, two things are on my mind, and I kind of wrote about both of these for Neiman, which Martin has written for a lot in the past year. One is how I think some of the, and you can say a lot of it's chain ownership, but I think it's spilling out. There seems to be a race to the bottom in exchanging these ideas. How we're screwing some of that up right now, and then how newsrooms can survive against that and survive in whatever environment. Some of the lessons that I've learned maybe in the past couple of years. I think I said 2 years ago, I remember nothing of that, but I'm sure I said, because I say it often, that, I love Bill's slide about service instead of product. The web fundamentally changed not our habits of viewing something on print versus a screen, but our relationship with brands and with each other and the ability to exchange information. And it shifted the power base to the individual consumer in a fundamental way. And so newspapers have been confronted with that transition from a dollar and cent standpoint. We've been talking about it in a panic way for almost 10 years. We talked about it before that as well. In a lot of, I think the worst offense at first was ignoring what was coming, inaction, going on business as usual. And in the past couple of years, I think it's gotten much worse in that we're seeing some tactics, particularly from chains, but I think it's spreading, that under the guise of saying print revenue is going to be a bridge to this digital future, which no-brainer, it should be. You should use that revenue to build something that will be sustainable. They're really, instead of realizing that the consumer and the customer is in charge, they're building a business model on deceiving customers, abusing those customers, and trying to get as much money as they can out of them. While, on the other hand, I'm not seeing the digital investment that will really get us there. So it's like we're treading water, or I think you said milk the cow until it dies or whatever, so I think a key part, if we're talking about the industry at large, and Don talked about the big picture of who's in control, is how these decisions are being made and what stake newsroom people have in it. I'll walk you through a couple of the tactics. So starting
with Matt.
Yeah.
I'm going to unplug this projector. Are you using it?
I'm not. Sorry.
Just
yep.
Doesn't that make? Or
yep.
Thank you, Martin. Sorry to interrupt you. I just thought.
Yeah. No.
There you go.
Starting with print edition subscribers, whether it's because they're loyal to your brand or because they really haven't figured out how to get the Hannaford circular, or otherwise, I don't know. I'm sure it's a combination of that. It's still a more stable revenue source than print advertising has been, for one thing. But secondly, it's people that you know are associated with your brand, some for a long time. And right now, if you're a print edition subscriber to a lot of companies, you could be paying, your bill could have gone up 60-70% in the past year. You could be paying $600 while your neighbor's paying $100. And in addition to that, you could be getting a special section on the history of the Boston Red Sox or whatever every couple months that you are actually being charged more for without realizing that you signed up for that by not reading the fine print, saying you had to call in and tell them you didn't want it. Mm-hmm. And then another experience that I had, I get 4 newspapers at my home. I got busy in the spring, and one of them, the subscription on one of them lapsed. I had paid for it a year in advance, which is fine. And former publishers will know you have a grace period, a generous grace period usually, so that, usually people like I did, you forget and it gives them a chance to renew their subscription. What I've never seen before until this year, and I think it's another one of these tactics, and it's tactics like, the kind of things that you would report to the Better Business Bureau, I got a letter from a collection agency saying I owed $12 or something for the grace period that I never signed up for in the first place. I committed to a year. And maybe there was fine, I'm sure that they're good at the fine print stuff that said somehow I could be liable for it. And then if you want to complain about that hire bill, or these, you figured out, I think there was one paper that did one of these special sessions that they were secretly charging you for, that was about the new Pope. Jewish readers figured out what was happening, or a Jewish reader figured out what was happening. He said, I would never have chosen to like really read about this, I don't really care, and I'm being charged for it. But try to get somebody on the phone to talk about that, and it's nearly impossible, because years ago, we outsourced our customer service to phone rooms far from Main Street and far from a structure where the person, when you get them on the phone, having the ability to do anything or having the authority to do anything about it, really knowing what you're talking about, even the ability to pull up your account. So we've gotten farther and farther away from maintaining and paying attention to what you think is the one thing that we have going for us, which is this loyal, local, engaged customer base. The one thing that sets us apart from the Google or the Pandora or whatever, they don't have that loyalty with the car dealer on Main Street, nor the relationship with the local sales force that delivers it. When I was a publisher, I used to remind my CERC director all the time about, we would go for like a cheaper option on customer service or whatever. When he said, it's just the 85-year-old grandmother who likes to complain a lot, that she didn't get it right on her porch or whatever. And I remind him that 85-year-old grandmother's son is the president of the bank, and her granddaughter runs marketing for the furniture store. And that's the local relationships and stuff like that have made a business. At the same time, so we're doing this to tread water, to make up for that loss of print ad revenue. But one by one, or actually even exponentially, we're turning off the customers, whether it's print or online, that will be our source of revenue a year from now or 2 years from now. We'll fund the newsroom, and instead of taking that money and investing it in digital, I see it just going to the bottom line. Because God forbid that we have a profit margin of 16% instead of 19%, so that we can build something that will have us not be at 0% 3 years from now. Some of the same tactics you see online, and there's a bridge over here. This is controversial in any kind of newspaper audience, because people are all going to paywalls and try to figure out how to keep funding the newsroom and monetize their content. But I would say, and Bill, please just get up and disagree with me, that very few people are paying for digital content purely. Almost every paywall that I've seen is bundled with print. Mm. It's a way to increase, increase the amount of money we're getting out of print customers by forcing them to pay for the online stuff too, whether they're using it or not. So at the same time that we're doing that, you go to the websites and you pull up any, you know, pick a chain website, okay? Except, you know, the bigger ones being an exception. Tribune has done better. You know, Washington Post, Boston Globe, New York Times, and run by more savvy people on user experience than this. But you do your typical community mid-sized daily newspaper, and you get a pop-up ad, a takeover ad. You click on a story. You know, it's slow to load. You click on a story, and you have to click four times to read to the end of the story. It's 1,000 words. You know, pagination. And you have that makes the user experience so bad that it inhibits traffic, inhibits customer loyalty, which puts more pressure on the newsroom to grow traffic, which gives us puts us in the position of everybody aggregating the YouTube video of the squirrel dressed like Elvis on a roller skate, you know, or minor school shooting in Alabama. It's not exactly the bread and butter of the Rutland Herald, but we all feel that we need to have that breaking news, national stuff, even if 5,000 people are doing it. And we do it in a way that is based on page views for ourselves instead of trying to get people to the information in the best customer experience as possible. The other piece that I wrote for Neiman was about survival. It's becoming more clear in my mind since I left. It was really about survival of the journalist and the newsroom, including their own personal well-being, whether they're there or not. I spoke at a conference in Germany a couple of years ago where the CEO of a Swedish newspaper chain had been very successful with the transition to digital. At the time, this was 3 or 4 years ago, they were more than 50% of their revenue from a previously print-oriented company was digital. They were heavily into mobile even back then. And he said, you know, you gotta stop having conferences about technology. Yes, you know, that obviously you should be all over that. You need to be talking about human resources, and not human resources in the sense of the sterile office and the forms and stuff like that, and the insurance benefits, but human resources in terms of how you're managing your individual people and their careers and their well-being and how they're part of your team and how they're able to change. He said, you know, you look out in your any ever-sized newsroom, and 40% of the people are good people doing good work, but they're absolutely hiding from you and hiding from the need to change because they don't know what it means for them. They don't know. They're afraid of it. And it's almost as simple as just taking the time to step back from the deadline and having meaningful conversations about them and what they're doing and who they are. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The one most obvious for this conversation is the digital skill sets and roles that we need in the newsroom now versus what we used to be. And the kind of continuous year-round learning environment that we need. You know, if you're doing investigative reporting that's important to you and you're not teaching your reporters how to use Excel and work with data and process all of the great stuff that you can get through FOI in a meaningful way, you got to be. If you're not dropping everything right now and focusing on your mobile platform and talking in story meetings about how this breaking news story is going to be viewed on the phone, you're in trouble. Your slide, the scariest thing about the whole morning to me, if you're a newspaper executive, is that slide that showed 70%, you know, the 70-20 number for print lopsided and the opposite for mobile, because you know that number is going to go, it's going right now, it's going to be very quick. And I went down a rabbit hole this morning. Someone shared on Twitter or whatever a video of Bill Gates doing a vertical leap over a chair like that from a standing position from some of these moments. And so so on YouTube, it recommended some Steve Jobs videos. I clicked on the Steve Jobs video, and he said, we need to start with the consumer experience and work back to the technology from that. And so we're building mobile apps, if we're even that far. How many of you in this room, if something was happening right now and you needed to read about it, would want to go download an app or go through an app instead of just clicking on a link and having it show up well on your phone and being able to read it? The other reason, to focus on human beings and resources is the toll that this whole transition has taken on us mentally and the mental health of people. A couple months after I spoke here a couple years ago, maybe this is the reason I can't remember anything. And we had a year where we covered two historic hurricanes that knocked out power for a week in Connecticut, in some places, including reporters' homes, where they were doing the reporting, and yet the kids were out of school, and they didn't have running water, and they were trying to figure it out. We had two historic blizzards. We had the Boston Marathon bombing that we covered. We had a long battle with cancer from one person who cared very much about the newsroom. We had a lunchroom person that everybody's bartender dropped dead at work. And we had another death of an employee. And we had a bankruptcy filing for our company in which everybody got a letter saying you're fired. Everybody did, and we can't say any more than that. And we had layoffs, and we had all this talk about ownership. And in the middle of all that, in December 2012, we had a shooting in San Diego County Elementary School. Mm. And we had kids who were 22, 23 years old, just out of college, covering the funerals of three or four five-year-olds in a week. Arguably a lot more difficult. We had people who had five-year-old kids, like myself at the time, covering that stuff. It was such an event that it was so extreme. Was the worst possible thing you can imagine covering with it. That to me, it ripped open the defense mechanisms that we've built up covering a lot of other shitty things over the years. It left us raw and more sensitive when we covered a little bit later the social media bullying of two 13-year-old rape victims in Torrington, Connecticut, and it exposed the court reporter who was going to the run-of-the-mill horrible person of the day that they were covering. It just, that stuff takes a cumulative toll on them. It's trauma in journalism and amongst journalists, in basically what we do every day. But then in the backdrop of this difficult transition that we're in, needs a lot of attention, and it is totally related to the transition and our ability to make the transition and be healthy and survive after that. And it's also that human resources focus on the newsroom is also important in building diversity, which is one of the biggest stumbling blocks that we have, not only to good journalism, but to the digital transformation as well, because the more diverse the newsroom is, women in positions of leadership, people of color on your staff, the more able you are to bring in different perspectives and skill sets. I don't even have to need to explain it, but that's something that we learned over the past couple of years as well. And I think the two are related in terms of you're in this environment where you're just trying to tread water and milk the cow until it's dead. until it drops. So just you got to question if you're the editor of a newsroom in that environment, what the priorities are, and create. And if you can't control them, create them for yourself. Start with your own people and caring about them, and that will, I think, help instill the number one thing that you can do to ensure the journalism survival is to focus on the reader and the customer, build a product that they love and a service that they love, and let the revenue people, help the revenue people, figure out how to monetize that. That's how all of the great companies started and had their success in the tech world in the past couple of years.
So Matt, not to interrupt you, but it feels like, you know, this is just to open up a discussion about really the human factor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How can we have better customer experience, better human resource practices, be more sensitive to our colleagues? It feels like, I don't know if there's a concluding statement, but to open it up for the next 10 or 15 minutes before lunchtime about the human factor, really.
Yeah, I mean, and I think... I think it's that human factor it relates to, I think, the feeling of helplessness, maybe the rank and file when we hear Martin's presentation and maybe dealing with it in our own shop. So.
I got a quick question. You recited the major news events that you had to cope with, you and your newsrooms in Connecticut over the last couple of years. And I think of them as all being big events, episodic events, events where your newsroom is overwhelmed and confronted by the news. Do you think there's any chance for a different paradigm around news, which I would call solutions journalism, where instead of waiting for the news to happen and being engulfed by it, taking a look at what are the needs, the information needs of a community, and trying to then focus your coverage around those things. And the reason why I ask that question, because I think it's very related to the mental health of the reporters, is if the reporters feel as if they are being consumed by the latest news tsunami, rather than being part of a community which is trying to help itself through and get to the other side of a bunch of difficult problems.
Some of the best therapy in Sandy Hook for our reporters was when they were able to move beyond the initial story and talk about how the community was healing, mm-hmm. And those solutions. So absolutely. The other thing that has been on my wish list to do somewhere at some point is, I'm a long time United Way board member and person, and we've done community needs assessments on social services and stuff like that, and I believe there's a huge opportunity for someone to do community, and maybe any news, every news can do this, community information needs assessment, to see the whole ecosystem of news in a community or a state, to show that it's not just the local newspaper, public radio, outfits like Ron Digger, subject-oriented startups like the Marshall Project or Connecticut Health Investigation Team, but it is homegrown grassroots ways of communicating in communities, right down to a very informal and non-tech, methods in some cases. The community near where I live in Connecticut, the biggest source of exchange of information in that community is a Facebook group. Mm-hmm. More so, far more so than the newspaper.
Talk about a little bit, because it sounds like you have experience with both community newspapers and what they bring to the table for a community, and the larger statewide news and how they would connect or not, or what it, what, well, how, so do, how do they play together?
So the biggest, so before I quit this past October, I had to lay off or buy out 33 of 110 people in my newsroom in Connecticut. And I spent the previous 2 years saying, we have 110 people. It seems like we're always stretched and stressed, and it's not enough to do what we're doing. We have a $7 million budget. You can't tell me if you have a $7 million budget, you shouldn't be producing something that you'd be proud to nominate for a Pulitzer Prize every year. You know, I said that over and over again. You know, give Vermont Digger a $7 million budget. Right? You know, it's just used to those kind of comparisons. And then you know what? If we got 60 people instead of 110, it's still 60 people. But it's a matter of deciding what you're not, I think, is maybe the biggest thing. And so do we go to the press conference that CAX and Vermont Public Radio and Vermont Digger and the other newspapers at? Is that together? Is that, yes, we all have great questions that the other person didn't think of, of course. But depending on the topic, you know, oh, the governor announced the thing we all knew he was going to announce. He's not going to say anything that we didn't know he's not going to say. Do you have a governor yet, by the way?
Good question.
And so it's making some of those kind of decisions, and we were lucky enough to partner with something called ctnewsjunkie.com, and for a while ctmirror.org, doing statewide news that a little different from each other, and we didn't send people to some stuff that they were doing, and we'd use that to free up resources to start a poverty beat. And some other stuff like that that was much more proactive in terms of looking at and things that weren't just a reaction to a crisis. You know?
Yeah.
When you last spoke to this group, you talked about how you were trying to make the news operation more accessible to the public, more open. And I think you even talked about having editorial board meetings in public and actually streamed online. Did that openness continue? After that point?
Yeah, it did, and it ran into some roadblocks, which I'm going to start calling myself a self-employed newspaper consultant instead of an employed newspaper. part of the reason why I'm in that position now is one of the first things when those cuts came down this past winter, I had been working on a project for about 3 years that was about ready to lease sign and to open, which was a big downtown open newsroom in Nehaga, right on the Yale, near the Yale campus and stuff like that. In the middle of, you know, a lot of people today say, like to say that Yale runs the world, et cetera. In the middle of some great thinkers and the community, a very vibrant community that we thought would be the evolution of this experiment we did in the kind of small town Torrington, then where we had the open newsroom and the open editorial meetings and stuff like that. It can be done without that physical space, but that was a disappointment that was pluggers pulled on that. But yeah, it continued. I think it does continue. It was a big, it played a big role in Torrington. I don't think that we would have covered two really important stories in the same way if we hadn't gone through that first and built kind of those relationships and trust. One was the rape case that became a national story. It was on the heels of Steubenville. It raised a lot of important questions about rape culture, including rape culture as reflected in the media and some of our competitors referring to the rape of two 13-year-olds as a tryst in the headline, the front page headline, and stuff like that. So we felt we were in a really good position to have a community dialogue and be part of the solution because of that engagement. And the other one was a story that everybody was ignoring, and the police were shut down all information about to try to hide the fact that it was happening, which is a huge problem in Vermont here too, which was a town of 30,000, 12 young men dying of heroin overdoses last year in Torrington, Connecticut. And we were relentless on that and had an army of people cared about it, that were part of our reporting, you know, not reporting, but they were part of our team because it was that kind of relationship with the community, and they cared about it. It gets easy to get discouraged about it because they're not going to care about a lot of other stuff. It really have to write about. And so it feels like, yeah, no one's going to come to your meeting to talk about the planning board, regulation board.
Any other thoughts, questions for Matt? Do we know if lunch has arrived yet?
Yes. It has? Yes.
Okay. Don, something? Yes, one last question. Go ahead.
Matt, in keeping with your laudable practice of speaking only generically, I would like to say that I am a loyal reader of my local daily newspaper in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and I won't name it. But they have a website that I think is about as old as Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. And when I had the audacity to call them and ask them for a subscription price that would give me a discount because I didn't want the physical delivery of the newspaper, their customer service people actually behaved as if I was asking them something they had never heard of before. I mean, they did sort of like, this doesn't compute. And that didn't compute with me. Can you like put me inside that?
I can tell you why that is. Again, Bill studies more than I have. The market reality is you're a very unique person. There's very few people who want to buy digital only.
Really? Because it just seems like such a no-brainer, especially as a loyal Leaky Digger reader, that I would just want the same service from my local newspaper.
Yeah, that's why I think your work is important in terms of, again, let me pay very simply $10 a month or something like that and have access to whatever I want or whatever the structure or the model is to make it easy.
Don, I can probably say this, and Matt can't because I don't have to worry about non-disparagements. I suspect there's another possibility, and that is that they just don't want to acknowledge that that makes sense because they'll lose a lot of revenue, and so they're just, I don't know. I in Williamstown, for the last year, we got digital only access and 2 days a week of print to the Berkshire Eagle for $50. And at renewal time, it was going to be $250. Because I happened to have a discussion with the CERC manager for Digital First Media 6 months ago at a conference, I think it's because they realized that even though that was a pretty reasonable charge for what I was getting, there was no way they were going to continue to milk the cow till it drops if they were only charging $50 for a digital-only subscription for somebody who used to be paying $200.
So at the risk of confirming Alan Gilbert's bias that I'm always the utility regulator, that's a great design problem.
Yes.
I'm willing to pay the newspaper its reasonable cost of delivering a digital-only product.
Right.
It's a couple things, I think. It's that, and to your point, there's a company called Mather.
Mather Economics. Yeah,
that helps companies create these algorithms where they can create 50 different rates with 50 different people in this room based on your pain point or whatever, and determine that 10 of you, we don't care to subscribe anymore because the other 40 are going to pay more in math. It's that, and I think it's also just, I think that we just have, and this is one of the main points of my meeting thing, we have ignored and bled the infrastructure around talking to our customers, knowing what they want, and building rates, products, etc. around what they want, to our detriment. And it's at a time when technology is such that we should be, like Bezos, knowing as much as possible about every single customer who likes our brand and whatever, and not only giving them what they want, but selling them all kinds of other stuff related to what they like. You know.
Matt, thank you so much for coming.